This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting, and the taste? Lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
This is our league, and this is your league. Broadcasting from the 55-yard line in Japan to the shores of the Great White North and everywhere around the world on Gridiron America Radio and the Sports History Network.
Everybody, welcome back. It is Greg St. James, and this is another simulcast of Gridiron Japan and Gridiron America. And tonight I am with my old friend Joe Zimba, author of the book When Football Was Football, a book that was came out about 25 years ago, or 26 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, which is now coming up, is going to be re-released. A second edition is coming out here in May. And, you know, Joe, you're an old Joe's an old friend, and it's nice to see you again. It's been a while since we talked, and yeah, let's talk my favorite topic, the Arizona, Chicago, St. Louis Cardinals.
Oh, wonderful topic, and Greg, thank you. It's good to see you. We do miss you in Chicago. The Chicago Cardinals fans miss you as well. So,
oh, thank you. I do miss home, and I do miss driving by Old Comiskey Park and taking a look at where they used to play.
Very true. Since the Cardinals left in 1960, there's still a ton of fans who follow the Cardinals, whether they're in Arizona or we're in St. Louis, or maybe just in their memories. But it's been a few decades now. It's still a lot of interest in the Chicago Cardinals. So I'm just always grateful for the opportunity to discuss their history. And so thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. You're welcome. And for those who are listening who have not heard my previous interviews with you before, or don't even know anything about the Chicago Cardinals or the book or so on and so forth, explain to people, first of all, how you came to be a Chicago Cardinals fan, and more importantly, how you came to write that first book, which is basically a magnus opus, a very detailed history on the earlier, you know, the entire time the Cardinals were in Chicago, because the story it's a very personal story for you.
It is. Yes. Thank you. And Comiskey Park played in the creativity or the creation of this book too. My father had been drafted by the Cardinals in the 1940s. And he was one of those guys who just never really talked about his career at all. And as I got older, he passed away early. I had a box of stuff, and that included his contract with the Cardinals and letters from people like George Halas. And so I wanted to learn more about what happened at the training camp, which was held at Morgan Park Military Academy on the south side of Chicago. His contract was incredible, Greg. As a rookie, he signed for $110 a game, but in the NFL back then, you had to supply your own shoes and shoulder pads for the training camp. So it was pretty wild stuff. I wanted to find out more. And so, of course, went looking in the history books and couldn't find anything really about him or the history of the Cardinals. And so one night, my cousin Mike Coffeen and I were at Comiskey Park, which is the biggest tavern in Chicago. And after the game, and we had some adult beverages, we found a little store off of Navy Pier, And there, lo and behold, was a Cardinals hat, a vintage, one of those throwback things.
Mm-hmm.
With a tag on it that said 1947 NFL Champions. And Mike said to me, isn't that your dad? And I said, your dad's team? I said, yes, it is. I said, I never knew they won an NFL championship. And this is going back to the early 90s. And he said, you should write a book about it. And I said, yeah, I'm going to write a book about it. Well, many of us, of course, say we're going to do this or that after we've had some adult beverages. But I bought the hat, still have it, still have the tag on it.
Yeah, I still have mine. I got mine. I know what cat you're talking about.
They are great. And immediately I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to put together a book and find out why there's no history of the Cardinals. So because of my dad's limited documents he left behind and Comiskey Park, which I then discovered was the home of the Cardinals, I dug right in, started writing a book and trying to contact players. And that led to When Football Was Football coming out in 1999. It's a big book. It is truly everything you ever wanted to know about the Chicago Cardinals before they moved in 1960. And now the opportunity to do a second edition with McFarland Books came up. And it's been like a dream come true, really, because I've learned so much more about the Cardinals. And there's so much more research information available now, particularly the Dutch Sternemann collection at the Pro Football Hall of Fame, that I felt I was really able to add quite a bit. So it's going to be a big book that comes out with the second edition. A couple of things we're missing the first time was an index as well as a list of specific resources. But I guess I have to give credit to my dear wife, who at the time said, she's a librarian, said, save all this stuff. You may need to prove it for whatever reason.
Right, yeah.
I knew that. 25 years later, I would need to look at these original manuscripts and microfilm copies that I made so I could go back and prepare an index and prepare the resources.
Yeah. With all that, because for those people who don't know, after you wrote the first book, you wrote several books after, you've written other books after that, including the Bears Cardinals book.
Yeah, the Bears Cardinals is Bears versus Cardinals, the NFL's oldest rivalry. And that came about while I was researching that first book, although it was many, many years later that it came out.
Yeah.
I always go a little crazy when if the Bears and the Packers are playing and the announcers always say it's the NFL's oldest rivalry. And I always get mad and I throw things to the TV, although it's certainly not the TV's fault. But I thought, well, maybe if I set this straight, showing that the Bears and the Cardinals played a year before the Packers even joined the league. And so it's full of a lot of fun stories from both teams, a little bit of new history about George Halas, but mostly getting into the blood and the mud and the beer with the Bears-Cardinals rivalry when they played. It was not a family fun fest, although some of the fun-loving fans in the stands would do things like throw bottles at the players or join in the on-field fights or set fire to the bleachers. But again, that was just the fun-loving fans in Chicago. So I wanted to bring that little bit of knowledge. It really doesn't mean that much to say who's the oldest rivalry, but it's nice to see now that pretty much everything I hear always refers to the Bears-Cardinals as the oldest rivalry. Certainly not the most played, because the Bears and the Packers still play every year, twice a year.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you with, because we're going to kind of bounce around all here talking about Chicago, about the Cardinals, and even about the Bears and the NFL. But, and I was just thinking about this, how different would the sports landscape be, just say in a perfect world, if the Cardinals had not left Chicago?
Ooh, that's something I've thought about quite a bit. I think it'd be a lot different. I think the Cardinals might have been able to turn the table and become a little more successful and prominent in Chicago. The whole way they left in 1960, George Halas was part of the NFL group that gave the Cardinals $500,000 to move. And that's a ton of money back in 1960. But I think the landscape would have seen the Cardinals maybe in a different division. Of course, they were in the 50s.
Yeah.
But the rivalry would have probably continued. And by now, with Chicago expanding so much more south than it had north, you might see a whole huge base for Cardinals fans that weren't there before. We'd probably see the Cardinals playing in Soldier Field rather than the Bears, which which they've done for many years. War would have prompted one or two or both of the teams to have their own stadium, or might they be like a Chicago, or excuse me, the California teams for a while sharing a stadium? So yeah. I think the sports land case would have changed that. The Cardinals would have been a little more prominent had they been able to stay, especially with the TV money.
Yeah, I was going to say, and with that said, you know, when the Cardinals were in Chicago, they were always breaking even or losing money. I mean, it's a question in reading your books, and I've been to three of your lectures that you've given around the Chicago area about the Bears, about the Cardinals. And, you know, when you talk about the Cardinals, the Bears are always like the second topic there. So it's always the Bears and the Cardinals. But when it comes to the Cardinals, they were always a team way back when that was always living, you know, from basically paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I mean, financially, they would have been, again, in a perfect world, if they were still in Chicago, financially, you know, once the TV money came in, mm-hmm. things would have been way different for the team.
That certainly would have changed things, because they were mostly getting income, of course, from attendance, which was pretty bad in the 50s. It was so bad that often they couldn't afford to pay the guarantee for the visiting team. So they relied on. Yeah, so it was one of the reasons they actually were kind of forced out by the league.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that was bad. Of course, the Cardinals wanted to move from Comiskey Park in 1958 to Northwestern to play in Dyke Stadium. And George Halas implemented a rule called the Madison Street Agreement that was between the Cardinal owner, which was Dr. David Jones in the early 30s, and Halas, that no one ever heard about. In other words, the Cardinals couldn't play north of Madison Street. The Bears couldn't play south, which, of course, where Soldier Field is now. And so the Cardinals were refused to move. In fact, in one of your recent episodes, you had a fantastic interview with Upton Bell. And his dad, of course, was the commissioner at the time. And he had a rule on if the Cardinals could move. And Upton told me that it was the most difficult decision that his father had to make, because Halas had this agreement. No one has seen it. I haven't. The Chicago History Museum, the Washington Library, the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Nobody's got a copy of it.
But Halas apparently had it. I thought it would show up in the Sternman papers in the Dutch Sternman collection at the Hall of Fame, which was released many years ago or a few years ago, but it's not in there either. But yeah, that's part of the issue, is the Cardinals not having the finances to compete without the TV money.
Well, knowing what we know about old man Halas, you know, would not surprise anybody to imagine that if there was a paper, that paper got burned right there and after. I mean, you know, for anybody who knows the history of George Halas, his personality, he was a fighter, and if he could bend the rules a little bit to get things to go his way, he was kind of all for it. And so it kind of begs the question, had the Cardinals been able to move to Northwestern and play at the stadium, how different the NFL would look today.
Yeah.
And it's more like, again, a butterfly effect. What would have, the Cardinals, if they would have been a Northwestern, the move to St. Louis would have never happened. The mm-hmm. AFL would have gone to St. Louis. I mean, you can just kind of piece out. So imagine so many different scenarios. But with the Bears now, like with the modern history of the Bears, because right now everybody is guessing. Well, I wouldn't say they're guessing. We're presuming that the Bears are moving to Indiana.
Yeah.
So the stadium situation in Chicago, for really all of the sports teams, has always been a challenge. And when it came to the Cardinals, they played on the south side of Chicago, but for a team that played in Chicago, it had more homes than any of the other sports teams. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, off the top of my head, I can count 4 home football fields.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And if you're looking at the types of teams that have been around or were around, 1926, there was a Red Grange League.
In
the 40s, the All-American Football Conference was here as well. So I think Chicago could easily still support 2 teams.
Yeah. And so going back to the early years of the Cardinals, for those who don't know the history of Chicago, of professional football in Chicago, so everybody thinks it starts and ends with the, it began and it ends with the Bears, but far from it. Explain to enlighten people in terms of what the landscape was like back in the early 1920s when the NFL started, and really how integral, I mean, how important the Cardinals were to that start of the NFL.
Yeah, the Cardinals were so important. The team itself started in 1899 as the Morgan Athletic Association, which is just a bunch of kids playing on the south side of Chicago. And then for a season, they became the Morgan Athletic Club, and then changed in 1901 to the Cardinals Social and Athletic Club. So that's where the nickname came from. But the team was around when the NFL started. Chris O'Brien was one of the founders of the team, along with his brother and one of their neighbors back in 1899, kept that team together for those years. And supposedly, I haven't seen any firm proof, but I've seen it referred to in different publications that O'Brien had to approve the move of the Decatur Staleys to Chicago, where they were the Decatur Chicago Staleys in 1921, and then finally the Chicago Bears in 1922. So O'Brien and the Cardinals had a great deal to do with the start of the NFL. And most importantly, what would we have done without the Chicago Bears? They were so influential and prominent from the very first year. George Halas and Dutch Sternman, his partner, got things going in Chicago, although it was tough financially. But the Cardinals were there first, as you just mentioned. And so the fact that they were here and they were able to have a competitive team, they went from a sandlot team to kind of a semi-pro team in the late teens, and then started recruiting the big schools as the NFL started.
All right. And when professional football began, and when the NFL began in the 1920s, the guys who played on all the teams, they were paid, you know, good sums of money for back then to play. Mm-hmm. But these were also guys at the same time still held full-time jobs.
They did. And most of the Cardinals worked at the Chicago Stockyards, which was just a mile or two north of where their playing field was at 63rd Street. And the Stockyards were it's a couple, 3 miles away. So the players, even throughout, I know when my dad was recruited to play in the NFL before he was drafted, teams like Detroit and the Bears said they could set him up for a good off-season job to make a career for himself. So even then, in the 40s and 50s, players were having part-time jobs. And way back then, the beginning, Paddy Driscoll of the Cardinals, who was an All-American in Northwestern before he got kicked out of school for playing professional baseball with the Cubs, he was the highest player in the NFL, making $300 a game. But in some of the documents we've seen, it looks like maybe $50 a game was the natural for a backfield man, and maybe $25 for a lineman. And then in the 1923, the Sternman collection, which I referred to, Dutch Sternman being the partner of George Halas until 1931 or 32, he kept all of his records. And for the first time, we saw exact salaries that were paid to people in the 20s. They were paid by game. George Trafton was the highest paid for the Bears, making, I think it was $75 a game. And if you got hurt, you didn't get paid.
How much have you gone and to the computer or AI and asked how much that money would be in today's dollars?
Oh, I did once. Yeah. It wasn't very much, you know,
really,
even $100 a game back then wasn't very much. In fact, Halas, when he got out of the service in 1919, he had told his mother he was done with football. He had played with Great Lakes and they played in the Rose Bowl. He was the most valuable player, but he came home, took his engineering job until he got a call from the Hammond Pros. And they were paying guys $100 a game. The only drawback for that was the checks were bouncing and the players actually had the owner arrested. But
I did not know that story. And the ironic part is now the Bears are probably going to Hammond anyway.
Yeah, they might be, yes, be returned for George Halas, where he first played in 1919.
And, well, what next I'd like to ask you, So with the Cardinals, there are a lot of key people that play an important history, that played an important part in the history of the Cardinals. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Chris O'Brien.
Yes.
So let's start with him. I just want to kind of go through some of those names. You've mentioned a lot of names, and for those who don't know much about the Arizona Cardinals or the history of the team, explain Chris O'Brien, because that's kind of he's the start of everything for this franchise.
Yes. He was the 18-year-old kid when he started the team in 1899. They had no money, and most of the revenue they got was from placing bets with other teams. But he stayed with the team until it entered the NFL. He was at that first meeting in Canton, Ohio, with George Halas. Very determined guy. A lot of the teams had money behind him. For example, the Staleys had the Staley Company paying their bills and supporting the team. Chris O'Brien had to raise money locally through friends or business people in the area. They certainly weren't going to make enough money with the attendance. But he kept things going. In fact, several people, including Red Grange, have credited Chris O'Brien with one of the real mainstays of the founding of the league, because he stuck with it. In fact, even in 1926, when the new league started, which was called the Grange League or the American Football League, they tried to get the Cardinals to move to that league, and he refused. He was very loyal to the NFL. He never made any money. The most he made was probably the first game they played with Red Grange in 1925. Now we know that the Cardinals made $14,000, by far the most the team ever made when O'Brien was the owner. But he finally had to sell Paddy Driscoll, his best player, in 1926 to the Bears. And then by 1929, he had sold the franchise itself for $12,500 to Dr. David Jones, who was the city physician for the city of Chicago. Of course, now, like the Bears, the Cardinals are worth billions. But I always remember I was able to meet Chris O'Brien's granddaughter, who said, he was a great football player, but he didn't really have the business mind to keep that NFL team going after that. So even on his death certificate, Chris O'Brien's occupation is listed as football owner and promoter.
Okay. And the team's home, its birthplace, was on the south side of Chicago, around, 61st and Racine. Is that kind of a ballpark here? I can't, I know Racine, but it's, with cross streets in Chicago, it's sometimes you get lost in the 60, 59, 50, But that's the ballpark area where the team began, and they played their early games over there at they didn't play their early games in Comiskey Park. They played them at Normal Park. And describe Normal Park, because I don't know if my description of it would be as good as what you can give.
Yeah, there were two Normal Parks. One was about a mile east of 61st and Racine, 63rd and Racine. And that was just a baseball stadium. It wasn't long enough to have a full football field. So they had to, when you advance the ball, I think, to the 20-yard line, the ball was brought back to the 40, so you would have a fake feeling of a 100-yard field. And that was some of the early games. They also played just on any vacant field or any park district field they could find without stands. People would stand around the old gridiron and with ropes, stand behind the ropes. And then in 1915, the new Normal Park was built at 61st, 63rd, and Racine, which was by a private owner. And Chris O'Brien was able to rent the field for $20 a game, provided he cleaned up after it. So that was a little bit of the history of their field. A couple of years later, they started playing games at the White Sox or Comiskey Park. And 1926 got bounced out of there by the new league and went back to Normal Park. And then finally, they were able to play their games until they moved into Comiskey Park, except for 1959, the last season. They played in Soldier Field, where the Bears are now. At that time, it still held well over 100,000 people before remodeling. Yeah.
And then there was in the 1930s, too. I don't mean to interrupt you, but they played at Wrigley, too.
They did. Thank you, Greg. They did. The Cardinals thought, because they weren't drawing a lot of people, that if they moved to Wrigley Field where the Bears were, Bears had bigger crowds, that people naturally would come to the Cardinals game. Well, the Southsiders didn't want to go to the Northside Stadium, and certainly the Bears fans didn't want to watch the Cardinals. So it kind of backfired, although they stayed there throughout the entire 30s. It was kind of tough. And one of the reasons was he had the Cubs Park playing, and if they went late in the season, then the Bears got first choice of home games. So often the Cardinals didn't get a home game until maybe early November when it might be snowing in Chicago. So it was tough to draw people there.
Yeah, because the Cubs back in the 30s were actually a decent team.
And, they were, yeah.
You know, they were going to the World Series every, you know, every couple of years, I think. So, and so that move to Wrigley, I mean, it is a, I mean, it's a long drive to get from the south side of Chicago to the north side nowadays, just by car. So I can't even imagine really what kind of, if you're a diehard Cardinals fan in the south side and they move to Wrigley, just how much that, it'd be like the whole team moving out of town.
Oh, almost. Yeah.
I mean, effectively, it's like they left town. So, so that rivalry with the Bears, describe that, because to me, I mean, you wrote a whole book upon on that rivalry with the Bears. Just how intense, I mean, people talk about how intense the Packers Bears rivalry is now and other teams in the NFL, but man, you know, the Bears Cardinals rivalry was, you know, to read your book and knowing what I know about the history of both teams, you know, I don't think people can fathom just how big that rivalry was.
Yeah, Drew, if the Cardinals were maybe drawing 10,000 for their games when they played the Bears, it was 40,000. So that was one reason. But it was similar to the White Sox and the Cubs, except the White Sox and the Cubs couldn't play each other. So it's that rivalry and the fan loyalty back and forth. But in the early 20s, it started out calmly enough. Well, the very first game, there's a good example. They played at Normal Park. The Decatur Staleys were undefeated. They were up 6-0 late in the game when a guy named Lenny Sachs, a defensive end for the Cardinals, recovered a fumble, went in the end zone at Normal Park. But it wasn't just any kind of return for a touchdown. Patty Driscoll kicked the extra point for the win. But since, as I mentioned, there wasn't a lot of seating, there were fans gathered around the sidelines, and apparently the Cardinals fans helped themselves and went on the field and provided blocking for Lenny Sachs as he went into the end zone. So Halas was fuming about that for years. I mentioned an article even in the 30s that or 40s that Red Barber, the great sports writer, recalled that with Halas and how he was still upset about that. He couldn't believe it. And what happened was the fans provided that an excursion into the end zone. But even other stuff contributed. In 1922, the Bears and Halas and Sterneman signed the great Patty Driscoll from the Cardinals to be not only a player, but one-third owner of the team. Problem was that Driscoll and Halas ignored the fact, Sterneman and Halas ignored the fact that Driscoll was under contract to the Cardinals. And so Halas got his hand slapped a little bit and had to release Driscoll back to the Cardinals. So that kind of started a little bit of the feud going. They had an all-out brawl in 1922, and this is my favorite story, where a rough tackle on Driscoll by Sterneman and Halas. They threw Driscoll headfirst to ground. He woke up swinging, and a brawl broke out. Players from both sides, fans from both sides, police came in on horseback to break it up. And Chicago Tribune, I think, said something about Halas was knocked to the ground, and he had a guy straddling him with a .38 pistol to his head. So it was quite interesting. Ed Healy, who had been picked up by the Bears a week before as the first free agent of the NFL, he said, "Oh, my God, here I am. I'm supposed to get $90 a game or something, and here I am liable to lose my life." It was that Al Capone crowd out there to protect their idol, Patty Driscoll. But a neat comment on that whole situation in his autobiography by Halas, written 40 years later, he said, "Yeah, we lost the game 6-0, but everybody had a good time." So, So the rivalry did continue. It eased up a little bit when Charles Bidwell took over the team because he was in 1932 or so, 33. He was actually one of the administrators of the Bears. He and Ellis got along well, but when Bidwell passed away in early 1947, that left the team with his wife. She soon married a guy named Walter Wolfner, who knew nothing about football but got in immediate feuds with Ellis. And so probably some of the best stories came out in the 1950s because Hallis and Wolfner didn't get along. But along the way, we had complaints about the grass at Comiskey Park being too tall. Hallis complained about. The Cardinals complained. The Bears were spying on their practices on the south side. And in the 30s, of course, the teams both would use Wrigley Field. So they had to clean out everybody from the stadium before practices started. But don't forget, there's apartment buildings across the street at Wrigley that they found guys they thought spying. So Cardinals sent people up there to find out, and it was four guys playing pinochle. But that happened. So, yeah, it was a crazy rivalry marked by fights. And even when the Cardinals were really bad in the 50s, they destroyed the Bears once. And then both teams had a great time getting in a giant riot fist fight after the game.
Mm-hmm. Well, in talking about the rivalry, there's, you just mentioned Charlie Bidwell, mm-hmm. and just how Charlie Bidwell bought the Cardinals at a time when, you know, you could buy a franchise for, you know, a song. What was the reasoning? What was the story that, you know, Chris O'Brien sold the Cardinals?
Yes.
But then Bidwell, then a few years later, bought the Cardinals. What were the circumstances of that for that transaction to come about? Because there is a whole story behind it as to why the Cardinals got sold.
Yeah. And Dr. David Jones was the owner at the time. He got a really good deal on the Cardinals, but he had a lot of different interests besides his medical occupation. He owned apartment buildings and businesses in town. So he was starting to get stretched a little thin. And I'm sure he was seeing also that there wasn't much money coming back at the time. So supposedly on Bidwell's yacht or boat in Lake Michigan one night, that I think Hallis and he were talking, and Hallis mentioned that Jones was interested in getting out of the NFL business. And so a deal was made pretty much on the spot, I think, where Dr. Jones would sell the team to Bidwell. Bidwell still owned part of the Bears. He had a small stocks and some ownership in the Bears that he had to get rid of.
Because Bidwell was a very wealthy man at the time.
He was. He was so involved in not only horse racing and dog racing in Florida and Chicago. He was part of Sportsman's Park. He had a women's softball league that he started that was successful nationwide. He was just in a lot of different things that he enjoyed sports. He's involved in running Chicago Stadium as well. So just a guy who really knew how to make money. He was a lawyer by trade, also kept that up. He owned Bentley Murray Printing, which later became one of those things that were printing tickets for gambling, I understand. I can never confirm that, but that's one of the things, stories you hear over the years. So he had his hand in a lot of things, and most of them were successful, except financially for the Cardinals. But he finally managed to try and turn that around in early 47 by signing Charlie Trippi, which really led to the championship, but he had passed away in that spring of 47. But yeah, once he passed, as I mentioned, the feud seemed to ignite and accelerate between Hallis and the Cardinals.
Because Bidwell died when he was relatively young.
Early 50s. Yeah.
He's buried at the mausoleum in a mausoleum. Mm-hmm. Actually, I would say about a mile from where I used to live.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. I have visited his mausoleum prior to me moving over here to Japan. That was one of those things I, you know, discussing with one of our fellow podcasters, Randy Snow over at the World of Football podcast. Mm-hmm. He likes to visit the grave sites of famous athletes. And as we were planning a day of going to visit, you know, some of the prominent Chicago ones, including George Hallis and Jay Berwinger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. you know, I took a look, did a little digging. I go, wait a minute, Charlie Bidwell's at the mausoleum down on, you know, down on Cermak.
Yeah.
Okay. So we made the trip down there. But with Bid going back, you know, he died a young man. So the team passed to his widow, and then his widow, Mrs. Bidwell remarried. Do you think had Charlie lived, and this is just a hypothetical, do you think the team would have been more successful?
Ooh, yeah, absolutely. And he had enjoyed running the Cardinals, but really went all out to build that 47 championship team and didn't get to see it, of course, but it looked like he was starting to see that the Cardinals could make it financially. The crowds were really big. 47, right. Even into 48 when the team was even better. And I think if he had been there to manage it, because by that time he certainly understood the National Football League and how to make deals and how to go about business with the other owners. He knew everybody. Well, I think for sure the Cardinals would have been a dominant team in the 50s, and likewise. And we talked earlier about what if he was around, yeah, he was still a young man. He still would have been in his early mid-60s. When the team left in 1960. So I think Bidwell's passing really had a tremendous impact on the team having to leave Chicago. And of course, Halas would have liked him and liked the team. So we wouldn't have seen Halas kind of pushing the Cardinals out. Although something would have had been done with the blackout rule at the time.
Right.
Meant if one team was playing out of town and the other was in town, they couldn't televise the game back. And so that really crippled both teams in terms of popularity with the television rule, really, because people couldn't see the games. I just talked about that in a program this week in Des Plaines, where people remembered that blackout rule and how they would go to South Bend or Milwaukee or Rock Island to watch the Bears games when they were kids. So
yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the NFL still does that with geo blocking now in the 21st century with. You know, I'm able to watch NFL games here with a different streaming package, but you know, it's kind of the same thing. It's like, you know, you're locked out, but people don't, when you mentioned TV blackouts back during that day, I'm not old enough to remember the complete blackouts, but I'm old enough to remember those years where back in the late 70s, you know, the news story would be, if the Bears don't sell another 3,000 tickets, nobody's going to be able to see it on TV because you have to have so many people in attendance for the game to be televised.
The sellout rule too, yes.
Yeah, the sellout rule. And so now, I mean, we don't have that nowadays, but maybe in a way we're kind of reverting back to it, because now all these games are on streaming and so on and so forth. The federal government was heavily involved back then in, you know, dictating what could be broadcast. They still are now to a certain extent. But back then we didn't have, I mean, the game was on TV, aerial TV, and if the game was blacked out, you couldn't see it. But like you said, the only way you could see it was by trek, you know, caravanning down to, say, Champaign, Urbana, or South Bend, and, you know, watching the game at a bar somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I found a really great quote from George Halas himself, who said it one time in the, I think it was about 47 or 48, he said, "Television, bah. Who's going to watch a football game in your living room?" And of course, last Super Bowl, I think, had 121 million people doing exactly that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing just even, I mean, you know, in our lifetimes, how much the technology has evolved and how much it has changed things. But just if you were a player or owner back in the 1940s, and this was a question I wish I would have posed to Upton when I talked to him the other day during our interview. We touched on it a little bit about the gambling aspect of it, but just how much things have changed from, I mean, just off the field for the game of football and for sports in general, but with football, with gambling and stadiums. I mean, the list is endless. What do you think about kind of where we're at now when you compare it to back in the day?
I think one big thing is the medical part of it. I was talking to someone about, we hear so much about the brain injuries and what the league has done and kickoffs, et cetera, to protect players. And back then, did the players have these injuries? Because they were proud to say they didn't use their heads. They didn't have face masks. So we had a few broken noses, of course.
Yeah.
But they would tackle with their shoulders or their thighs or their arms, of course, and hit low or hit wide and hit high. But they didn't lead with their head. So I think that's one of the big things. Scheduling and equity is big now. I'm doing a podcast now where the Cardinals played something like 51 out of 52 games in the early 20s at home because the scheduling was all over the place. You could play who you wanted, and that caused a lot of confusion in the early days. Now we've got teams that you know who you're going to play next year, and Upton Bell brought this up in your interview with him about how his dad said, well, I'm going to have the bad teams play the bad teams, the good teams play the good teams when he was putting the schedule together. And we're still following that and getting the division rivalry. So I think those are two of the big things, the concern for the player safety and the more equitable scheduling and the profit sharing, of course, too. But
right. There's
so much money now involved. And everywhere you look, there's some kind of money that's even as we talked about, the streaming of the games and how to get access to the games and the packages you have to buy. It costs a little bit of money to enjoy a game that you've loved all your life.
Yeah. I mean, just, I think my wife was the other day, we were watching a Dodgers game here in Japan. Mm-hmm. Imagine that. Everybody in Japan is a Dodgers fan. But we were watching the game and they asked me, well, how much do you think those tickets are like right behind home plate? And I go, well, we couldn't afford those. We couldn't afford those. And just talking about that, just to buy a ticket to an NFL game, it's insane. So, yeah, now the world is changed. It's not only it's changed quite a bit, but it's still constantly evolving. And football's evolving right with it. With all these changes, I always keep going back to the what ifs. The butterfly effects from way back when. What do you think were some of the big turning points for the Cardinals that kind of affected to where we're now? And I'm thinking about one of them. You may not have even thought about yourself. What if George Halas had actually been on time for that boat?
Yes.
On the Eastland. Yep. And so for those who don't know what I'm referring to, because but for him waking up late, the NFL could look completely different than what it does today.
It could be. In 1915, when Halas was in college, he was working for the Western Electric Company in the suburbs of Chicago. And the whole company was going to go to Michigan City for a day picnic. And Halas was on the team, a company baseball team, was going to play a game, but he was late. He missed it. And had no idea that in the Chicago River, the Eastland had so many people on it, and they all went to one side of the boat. It literally tipped over. It was the worst loss of life in U.S. history, I believe, on a maritime disaster. Halas had no idea. He didn't know anything about it until that night. A fraternity brother came and knocked on his parents' house to offer their condolences because Halas had been printed. His name in the Chicago Tribune is one of those lost because he was late. He figured he just missed it, knew nothing about the disaster. And Halas just said, I guess I was lucky that day. But what if Halas, all he accomplished in putting together the NFL, would we have had that? I'm not certain that it would have gotten off to the start it did, or if ever.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's these little what-if questions. Because I sit over here in Japan, and I like my sports simulation stuff. So football simulation, and that's something now that, you know, I'm back regularly on the Sports History Network here at Gridiron Japan, but also at Gridiron America, doing shows on the what ifs.
Yeah.
And trying to use computer modeling, you know, for little questions like, and this is just an example, what if the Cowboys had traded up for Earl Campbell? What, you know, would Dallas have been the dynasty? Would Dallas have, you know, a three-peat there? Going from 77 to 78, 79, so on, by having two powerful backs in the running field. So questions like that. So with the Cardinals, kind of on the same wavelength, What are some of the biggest what-ifs, do you think, with the Cardinals?
The biggest, as we talked about, was Charles Bidwell passing. A second one might have been, and this is a great question, if it's such a good question. Boy, you got me stumped here a little
bit. I didn't mean to stump you.
Yeah. But what if Curly Lambeau in 1951 had been successful as the coach of the Cardinals instead of actually getting pushed out? If he had been successful when the team was coming off of two great seasons in 47 and 48, what if the Cardinals had not traded away under Wolfner half their team after the championship?
Right, yeah.
They thought, we got to save money. Well, you got to put a product on the field. What if they had kept some of these great players and Pat Harder and Chet Bulger and Vince Benonis and even Paul Chrisman, the quarterback, in those two or three years after? So I think those are big ones.
Yeah.
Another one might have been, could they have taken the extra step with Dr. David Jones? He brought in Ernie Nevers in 1929, still holds the NFL record for most points in a game with 40 in a 40-6 win over the Bears that year. But that might be a good one. What if they had been able to continue, and this is going back almost to Bidwell and Lambeau, that great team of 47 and 48, even though they're getting a little older because they were all in the war. And at the same time, what if there had not been a war? The Cardinals would have been overloaded with all this talent. They had a fairly decent team going in before the war. The guys served. They came back. They drafted well. Could they have kept it up throughout the 40s instead of the Bears? So those are kind of what ifs. But what a great question. I never thought of that.
Greg. Yeah, that's something, you know, now, like I said, now that I'm back doing the – now that I'm back and I kind of run – I'm kind of the GM for both shows.
Yeah.
asking those questions because the technology is available to at least kind of in a way answer it, to kind of give a hint as to what would have happened. And, you know, my whole interest in sports simulation and what ifs is based on a George R.R. Martin short story called The Last Super Bowl. So, yeah, that's just something moving forward here in 2026 for both shows. You know, covering the Gridiron game here in Japan, obviously, but also adding more to it. And over at Gridiron America, you know, doing our thing over there.
Sure.
Also talking about current stuff with the UFL, CFL.
Oh,
and the NFL too. But yeah, no, I'm big in the big what if questions.
Here's another one that a lot of people may not know about.
Go ahead.
Now, we talked about the beginning of the NFL, and I was just thinking one of the neat things that's happened since the first book of When Football is Football came out was a gentleman named Jack Glenn, his uncle, his nephew came forward, and I have the saw copies of Jack Glenn, who was the general manager of the Cardinals in 1919 at the age of 19.
Yeah.
He was in discussions with George Gipp. What if George Gipp had he
lived? Yeah, I do remember the Cardinals? This story.
What a name that would have been.
Yeah, I mean, but didn't George Gipp die in college, though?
Yeah, he died about 19 or 20 or so.
Wasn't he?
There. Yeah,
I
thought
he was
but
still...
what if Glenn had survived? He died in 1919 of the flu going on. So I always wonder, well, what if they'd gotten George Gipp? Not only his talent, but the fact that he was so well known, similar to Jim Thorpe becoming the first president of the Professional League in 1920. A name like George Gipp for the with the Cardinals, although they ended up with Paddy Driscoll, but Gipp was certainly well known as well. But that's another one of those what ifs.
Yeah, those are questions that I, you know, as I like I said, when everybody in America is asleep, I'm up here by my, I'm here. It's daytime here. I got a lot of time to think. And those are, you know, as I've been going through lately, working on some stuff here in front of my computer and playing simulation football and, you know, playing the old Stratomatic computer version. I'm like, what if? So, well, let's finish up here. Let's talk about the book. Let's talk about the second edition. What are the significant, and maybe I can't remember now if I asked you at the beginning of the show, but I'm going to ask you again, what are some of the significant differences between the second edition and the first edition from, was it 98 you wrote the book?
Yeah, 99 it came out.
99, okay. I was thinking it was like 2000 for whatever for whatever reason. I was thinking 2000. But what are some of the the differences between the second and first edition?
Yeah, three of the big things I mentioned earlier: an indexed, a list of resources, and two full chapters at the end. One is what happened to all the cardinals that are mentioned in the book. And sadly, we've lost all of the 47 cardinals now.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole long chapter at the end or in the appendix that includes short stories that didn't fit in the book that are fun that I found. I can't document it all, so we mentioned that. But in the book itself, so many more resources are available. When I did the first book, everything was done by microfilm. At the Chicago History Museum is where I found out the first Cardinals game. I went to Coldwater, Michigan to find out about the first out of town training camp they did in 28 or 29. And now I feel guilty because sitting home with access to all the newspaper services, you can add find articles from all the competing teams, say if they played the Eagles in 47. Now I've added information from the papers from both towns, which has really been helpful. And then I've also been able to do interviews with new people. For example, I mentioned Jack Glenn, his uncle, his nephew, Pat Glenn, members of Arch Wolf, for example, was the general manager of the team. His grandsons were both kind enough to talk with me. Added a lot of photos, almost all new photos that have been added that we found since that time. Because with eBay and things like that, I've been able to collect like mad old Cardinals photos, and other people have been kind enough. The Chicago White Sox.
You're on eBay collecting looking at stuff.
Yeah.
Your wife's has a close eye on it. You got to be careful. That eBay stuff is addicting. Yeah. eBay stuff is addicting.
And so we've got a lot of new photos, people from the White Sox, example, Mike Busick, who's been an administrator or management of several professional sports teams. Talked about the reunion the Cardinals had. Darren Urban from the Cardinals in Arizona has been helpful. So getting different interviews and different articles and different quotes and fun stories has made it, it's going to be a big book, a lot bigger book. But like I said at the beginning, everything you ever want to know about the Chicago Cardinals will be in there.
Cool. And with the team, is the team, I know, you know Mike Bidwell and you know. Yeah. And the team, you know the owner of the team. How is the team? They've always been helpful to you. And when you and I have talked, and you've indicated, they've always been gracious in that. With the second edition, are they going to put on anything? Are they going to do anything?
I think we will. We haven't talked specifically about it, but when doing the interviews with everybody, we talked about maybe being able to do something. I don't know yet for sure, but we'll be doing a lot of stuff in the Chicago area. And then another book is coming out later this fall on Mats Tinelli. Yeah.
Yep. I wanted to ask you about that before we wrapped up. Let's talk about Mats and his importance not only to the Chicago Cardinals, but also to the story, kind of the narrative with war veterans.
Yeah.
For those, and go on, I'm going to let you explain who Mats Tinelli was and why he's important, not only for the NFL or for the Cardinals, but for America in general.
He is Mario Mats Tinelli from the north side of Chicago, played at Notre Dame. Took a season off to be a coach, then got signed by the Cardinals in 1940. And after that 1940 season and early 1941, he volunteered for the service. We weren't at war, but at that time, apparently, if you served your 1 year, you got out. So he had told his teammates, "I'll be back in a year, boys." The Cardinals blessed that. Bidwell was okay, and so he went into service. Unfortunately, he was in the Philippines the day after Pearl Harbor, and he was part of a four-month battle for Bataan, captured, suffered the Bataan death march, was imprisoned by the Japanese during the entire war. But I met him 1993 or two when I was preparing for the first edition of When Football Was Football. He was the first guy that I contacted. And the reason I found him was he was given a talk on a Memorial Day about his experiences. He didn't really talk about football, but we became friends. I interviewed him over the next 4 or 5 years for the book. And in the back of my mind, I always thought, maybe we'll do a book on Mott someday. And that day finally came, and I still had the interviews I did with him from 30 years ago. Yeah. His family has been phenomenal. I've worked with his physician, and the Cardinals, Michael Bidwell wrote the introduction for the book. So the Cardinals are behind it. And every cent from the sale will go to the Mott's 58 Foundation in Chicago. So we're excited about that. But I think it's in terms of his influence, he was the title of the book is From the NFL to Baton and Back, because he played in the NFL, was one of the leading rushers for the Cardinals, went in the service, lost 5 years of his life, 4 years, came back. And it's so emotional. Even now, I'm just thinking about the way he talked about it. He got into one game with the Cardinals, and he owed it to the Bidwell family, because he went from 210, 215 to 90 pounds when he got out of the service, when he was released. And Bidwell came up to him in the hospital bed when he finally got back to Chicago. There were no bands to meet Mott's. It was his wife and his parents. And Bidwell came up and said, "Mott, you know, you signed a contract with the Cardinals before you left. We expect you to honor it." And he said he was in no shape. Bidwell knew that. He knew that. But because he got in one game and against the Packers, he was eligible for all the years in the service as part of his NFL pension, no matter how meager it was at the time. But the guy was just so amazing. The day of his only game that he played, instead of celebrating come back with his team, he took the time to visit in Wisconsin the family, who just found out, they had no idea that their son was lost in prison in Japan, and he comforted them. Then he became a politician in Chicago. He helped set up the Clean Air Act in Chicago. He helped eliminate some of the influence in voting by the remnants of the Capone gang. So always modest, never really liked to talk about it. I feel bad to this day that I kind of pushed him. But one of the neatest things was during the service, and he was in the service, and Greg, you know the story. He had a Notre Dame ring on. Yeah. That was his only possession, but the prisoners were not allowed to have any of their possessions. But one of the soldiers took it from him, and somehow, and I won't tell the whole story, it's a very big part of the book, he was able to get the ring back from a Japanese officer, and he found some compassion during all the bloodshed that he experienced.
It's an amazing story.
It is.
It really is. I mean, I've heard you tell that story many times. In fact, the first time I heard it, I think it was during the 98 Olympics, Winter Olympics that were being held in Japan. I don't know if it was NFL Films or if it was one of the local channels that did a whole story on Mott.
I think they both did.
Yeah. And that was when I first heard about him. And he was still going strong back then. He was still going to Bears games, if I remember correctly.
He was Bears and Notre Dame and Cardinals.
And
the thing about him, he never mentioned anything that any effects. And now I find out through his family, his doctor, the awful pain he was in his entire life from the illnesses that he caught and the beatings he took. But the guy was amazing. Never talked about it. Very humble. Didn't know why anybody would want to write about him. But so it was kind of more than cool for me to have that experience with him and then come back all these years later and be honored by the family who allowed me to write his story.
Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to reading it. And speaking of reading, before we wrap everything up, let's let everybody know how they can order all your books.
Yeah, the books are available online through Amazon, of course. They're there now through McFarland Publishing, which has a website. Check that out, and under the football books. And I believe Barnes & Noble and Target have online stores as well that you could get the books at. And I plan on supporting these books through talks that I give all the time in the Chicago area or Arizona. But if anyone is ever having an interest in having a dull old guy talk, let me know. And we'll try and make that happen.
Well, you always bring snacks or something to all your talks. So
And prizes, very expensive prizes.
Yeah, yeah. Your wife makes sure you're fully stocked with prizes and snacks. Yeah. You know, coming up, you know, for those who are listening, and I'm including myself in this as we're talking. Mm-hmm. Do you have any talks coming up, say, like in May, the last final 2 weeks of May?
Nothing in May. Last one was this past week in Des Plaines, but later in this year, right now, will be in Chicago suburbs of Mokena and Lombard and Whiting, Indiana, and there'll be several more. And we do have a Facebook page called Chicago Cardinals where we'll announce all of those.
Yep, and I'll definitely post a link to all that in the show liner notes after I get everything edited and processed, and you know, doing all the things, you know, the fun things, you know, that you do when you're doing a podcast. It's all the work afterwards. So, yep. So, hey, listen, everybody who's listening and watching on YouTube and listening with the podcast, thank you very much for tuning in. Joe, you stick around for the after show talk that I always do with all of my guests and our guests, both for Gridiron America and for Gridiron Japan. And yeah, no, thanks a lot for sitting down with me. It's been a long time since, you know, you and I go way back.
Oh yeah.
And it's good to see you again. Good to talk to you. Hopefully I'm going to see you when I come back here go back to the States in a few weeks. So fingers crossed. I'll let you, we'll talk more about that after we get off air. But yeah, no. And hey, when's the book on Mott's coming out?
Looks like it'll be October or so.
Okay, so we're going to talk more after that book comes out. And then when Football with Football is come, the second edition comes out, that comes out in May.
In May, correct. Yes, thank you.
Okay. And there is going to be an edition, a Kindle edition?
Yes, there is. Yes, for both books.
That's the key. For those who are wondering why I'm asking, I had to explain, Joe, the situation when I moved. I had to donate all my football books to dedicate to good football historians. All my books went to a good home when I left. So I'm pretty much electronic now when it comes to all my football history books. So that's why.
Nothing wrong with that.
No. All right, my friend. Well, listen, hey, thank you very, very much for joining me here today. And for those who are listening, we will be talking to you very, very soon. And if you are looking for us online, we're now part of the Sports History Network. Gridiron Japan is part of the Sports History Network. The From the 55 Yard Line podcast is now Gridiron America Radio and also on the Sports History Network. And hopefully we'll be seeing everybody and talking to everybody very, very soon. Bye-bye.
This is Billy Stacy of the St. Louis Football Cardinals, and the Cardinals are charging.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. we wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you got to do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.